Welcome to 180 Degrees, brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland and supported by the Government of Ireland. Our mission is to be at the heart of Ireland's energy revolution.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of SEAI's 180 Degrees podcast. My name is Fergus Sharkey. I'm the head of business supports and transport in SEAI, and I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Val Cummins, who's the operation and projects director for Simply Blue Energy, and very importantly, is our recipient of the Outstanding Contribution to Sustainable Energy during the 2022 Energy Awards. So it's very good to have you with us today, Val. I'd like to start off, I think a lot of people listening to our podcast will be aware of you and aware of your work, but maybe to start off with your career and how you initially got involved in climate and energy.
Okay, well, thank you for the lovely introduction, and it's absolutely fantastic to be here and to have an opportunity to contribute to the SEAI podcast, which I think is such an important platform for communicating all things climate and environment and energy. How I got to be in this seat chatting to you now here this morning, it really came from, I think, more than anything else, actually a passion for the marine. And when I think back to kind of what got me going, it was actually just a fortuitous opportunity when I was a teenager to hear about the Asgard, which is the Irish sail training ship. And I didn't come from a sailing background, but I kind of fell in love with the idea of going off on a tall ship. And wrote to the Department of the Defence at the time, the days when you actually put pen on paper and put a stamp on an envelope and sent a letter off on its merry way looking for some information. And I got a response back, which included a programme of the sailing calendar for the year. And look, I was smitten. I got to go on board my first trip. I got on board the Asgard in Dunleary and headed across over to Oban in Scotland. And then for many years after that, I used to spend my summers trying to get on board and doing different trips all around Europe. But I was on board the Asgard one afternoon, probably just crossing the Irish Sea or somewhere and looking out to sea. And just in my heart of hearts kind of said to myself, I want to have a career that connects me with the ocean. And I remembered that moment. And that really then set me on my path in terms of choice of courses and subsequently the road that I followed in terms of, I suppose, following my heart, which was the marine side, but very, very quickly then into just the possibilities that the sea has to offer, which is where I am today around the combination of the marine and energy side.
And I think that's something that's very unique and very interesting about you is that you came in to offshore energy really via the sort of marine science end of things. And you know, I saw you described by the Irish Times as the only person in Irish corporate life who has dissected 2,000 edible periwinkles. But there is that. So you've got this dotted line from nature, the sea flora and fauna of the sea. And then what you're doing now as operations and project director with Simply Blue and exploring offshore renewable energy opportunities. So how does one get from the love of periwinkles to the love of floating wind turbines? So can you kind of join the dots of how that career has flourished and developed?
Sure. So look, when I made that decision to really have a career associated with the sea, I went looking for courses. And I didn't really want to do marine biology or oceanography, which were the two kind of disciplines that were available here in Ireland at the time. I actually came across a course in Cardiff University, which was a Bachelor of Science in Marine Geography. Very unusual degree course. I ended up in their external examiner and still in touch with the course coordinators to this day. And it was just a wonderful opportunity to study biological oceanography, but then also things like hydrography, integrated coastal zone management, geographic information systems. It was just a wonderful foundation. And when I graduated from Cardiff, I came home to Cork and I landed in what was the Coastal Resources Centre at the time, a small research group. And there was a project that had been funded by the Marine Institute, which was been set up to try and really understand if the humble edible periwinkle, Litterina litterea, was being overfished. Because back in the day, there would have been a lot of hand harvesters, a lot of fishermen or housewives along the coast that would have gone out, particularly in the winter, to supplement livelihoods by picking periwinkles, which then would have been exported fairly routinely to France. But nobody had a sense as to what was the scale really of this enterprise, and was the level of harvesting going to be detrimental to the stocks. There was some anecdotal evidence that that it was. And so that was just a fabulous opportunity to work on a project where I got to, I had a little white van, and I had a quadrat, and I had a research assistant, and basically just driving all around the coastline of Ireland, identifying, you know, rocky foreshore ecological systems that looked like they could be good habitats, and then collecting specimens and analysing, you know, in terms of sexing and sizing and everything else, to try and get an understanding of the sort of the population dynamic. But the really lovely part of that project was, and I suppose that's what just appeals to me, it's the multidisciplinary aspect. There was also about the social economic piece. So I would go off up to County Louth and interview periwinkle exporters, you know, that were trying to operate in a black market and weren't necessarily predisposed to talk to whatever I was, 20 something, but would open up. And it was just a fantastic learning curve in terms of, when, if you're trying to understand a problem, you don't take one slice, you don't look at it in a linear way. It's trying to understand the ecological, the social, the economic. Yeah. And that was a project that I just, you know, I suppose I hit the ground running on that. I worked it up as a master's in zoology, and went from there then to really embrace the research centre that was the Coastal Resources Centre. That centre grew, and at a very young age, I was very lucky to get to head that up as the manager. And we headed down to the naval base on Hall Boland as a research group, thanks to funding at the time from Lewis Luxman, who also funded the Luxman Art Gallery in UCC and the Luxman facility in UL and others. And we were the first civilian group onto the naval base. And it just was a game changer for the research group to have a dedicated facility where we had space for our boats and our equipment. And managed to work with a fantastic team there. It grew to upwards of 40 people. And that just opened a world of opportunities in terms of research projects that were really focused through all that time on resource management. So not just periwinkles, going from periwinkles to fisheries, looking at coastal tourism, looking at that interplay between people and the environment. We spent a lot of time in those days over and back to Brussels, securing European funding and working in collaboration with some wonderful institutes around Europe. And that really was the basis for an academic career in University College Cork over the subsequent 21 years.
And can I ask you then, so where you're working there, it's very much, you know, close to marine biology and marine science. Do you have a moment in your career that you really started to connect that to climate change, and then maybe start to pivot your career towards, I suppose, solving a problem that interlinks both energy and emissions, but also, I suppose, the destruction of biodiversity and the natural environment?
Do you know, I remember a moment that was a milestone. It was one of those European projects that we were involved in leading. It was called CorePoint. It was about coastal research and policy integration. And there were different groups all around Northwest Europe working on water quality issues or various aspects like that. And it had been funded by the Interreg programme. And it was very much applying knowledge from research, and the target audience were local authorities. And when we finished the CorePoint project, and the output of that was very much about, well, how do you do integrated coastal zone management? The project had been very successful. And I remember being together with the research team and Professor Andrew Cooper from the University of Ulster in Coleraine, having a conversation about what would we do next? You know, knowing that there was a good basis for us applying for more funding, and that we were a good consortium and we could do something quite impactful. And I actually remember the day we just had a conversation, and Andrew saying, we should really focus our next project on climate change. And it was just amazing that there was a moment where that became sort of a decision that you would note, whereas now, you know, everything that you do, it's in your DNA, right?
Yeah.
But I remember that kind of, and the discussion about should we focus on climate change in the coastal zone. And there was a project born out of that called Diamond Core, which was all about building adaptation to different coastal scenarios in terms of flooding and storminess in Northwest Europe. But yeah, I remember that. And I'm trying to remember when it was. I'd say it was probably around maybe 2008, 2009.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was a point of departure of note.
And you sort of, you initially kind of got involved in more sort of offshore wave and tidal energy. And that's actually where our careers intersected at some point around 2010 or 11.
I was doing
a PhD in that area. And I'm just wondering, you know, what I find incredibly interesting about what you're doing now is that there's an often, you know, a stereotype of a project developer coming in, having no understanding of the ecology, the economy, the locations. Whereas what you're doing is you're doing project development, but you have a deep understanding of all of those pieces. And I'm just really interested in how can you bring that deep experience of understanding the ocean environment, the communities around it, into the work that you're doing now in developing, you know, what are large infrastructure projects offshore?
Yeah, I'm thinking back. So when our paths crossed, I was the director, I was seconded out from UCC at the time to head up IMERC, which was the Irish Maritime and Energy Resource Cluster. And that was another whole learning curve in relation to looking at where the opportunities were for innovation, working together at the time with the Irish Naval Service, with the National Maritime College, with the university. And we were looking for funding from government at the time for the Beaufort building, which now houses the MARAI Centre and the National Ocean Energy Test Tank Facility. And I think, you know, through all of that, it was about learning more about energy, marine renewable energy. At the time, we were very focused on the wave energy opportunity. And I got to work, I suppose, more and more with the engineering side of the house. And that became very interesting because that was about understanding, okay, well, the kind of technology that could be deployed into an ocean environment and what that could mean in terms of addressing climate change, for example, whether it's wind, wave or tidal. And so I got to meet some fabulous people. And I think in terms of, you know, where we are now as a company and my position within that company, I've learned a lot. But what I've learned is to recognise fantastic talent. And what I've learned is that there are just wonderful people out there. I'm certainly not unique, no more than yourself and Kerry and SEA and others, really passionate about this area, passionate about the marine environment. And what I've been successful in doing, I think, is really identifying those champions that stood out over the years, whether it was on the maritime side or the engineering side or the environment side, and pull together a team that's just really motivated about and by doing the right thing. And so that's a team that involves, you know, that scientific understanding and knowledge of the resource, but deep and intuitive knowledge about the need to work with communities and understanding that the social license to operate is probably the most precious gift that we have to achieve in relation to making all of this happen, and then the engineering side and so on. So
maybe just to wrap up on, you know, your career, could you talk about your role with Simply Blue Energy now and what you guys are doing and what are the big opportunities and challenges you're facing as a company?
Yeah, so look, I joined Simply Blue, I can't believe it, 2.5 years ago. Time has absolutely flown. And it was a big decision to leave the university and to launch onto the commercial side of the house. But it's not a decision that I've regretted for a split second. It's opened my eyes to a whole new world. I think there's a huge opportunity to achieve impact through industry. And Simply Blue, you know, is such a unique company. So fundamentally, Simply Blue Group, we're blue economy developers. And we are a global Irish company headquartered in Cork. And we're looking at really opportunities around multiple use of marine space and to see how we can achieve that through adherence to the Sustainable Development Goals, which are at the heart of everything we all need to be doing. Our portfolio is focused on really floating offshore wind. That's the largest part of really our activities. But we're also involved in developing low impact aquaculture projects in Scotland. We're driving on the development of a wave energy project here in Ireland. And we also have what's called Deeper Blue, which is where we focus on a lot of sort of the pioneering technologies. So we're interested in seaweed farming at scale. And we've invested also in carbon dioxide removal, and we're doing some research in that area, and really importantly in the area of e-fuels also. So maybe to sort of just hone in on the piece around floating offshore wind, that's what I spend most of my waking hours focused on. My role is I'm a director of the group on the board of the company, but I lead the Irish team, and in particular I am the managing director of the Emerald project and the Western Star project. So there are two floating offshore wind projects, one off Cork and the other off Clare. And floating wind is different to bottom fixed technology, which is the traditional technology that's typically deployed in relatively shallow and benign waters up to about 30 metres. Floating offshore wind, it's not piled into the sea floor. It's secured, for example, through anchors and moorings. And because it's deployed in deeper waters of circa 100 metres plus, then it's further offshore. That means that we can tap into the best possible wave resource and achieve really significant capacity factors. And floating offshore wind technology, it's not totally new technology. It's really a combination of technology that's been utilised in oil and gas in terms of floating production platforms for decades. But the trick, of course, is integrating that technology with a turbine at scale. So my motivation now is to ensure that as a country that we can meet first and foremost our climate targets. It's desperately urgent. You know, we've heard from the IPCC well over a year ago, Code Red for Humanity. COP on the biodiversity is just concluding. We absolutely need to see the deployment of large scale renewable infrastructure to have any hope of addressing the crisis that we're in. So for me, the real focus is on unlocking the potential that our oceans and seas have with regards to this floating offshore wind opportunity, which is quite enormous because of the extent of our ocean resource and because of the windiness. It's not called the Wild Atlantic Way for nothing. So it's really, for me, I just see this absolutely transformational new sector, which is floating offshore wind, evolve off the south and the west coast. That just hits the triple bottom line that for me is vital. It's about protecting the planet. It's about people and it's about prosperity. It's about livelihoods in the coastal zone. And going back to the periwinkle harvesters back in the day when maybe that was, you know, as much as you could hope to do is to maybe eke out a living from fishing or from, you know, harvesting periwinkles. What I see now is this huge opportunity to breathe life back into coastal locations where fishing, sadly, is an industry that is in demise. Yeah. There has been consequences from overfishing. But again, let's just be really smart. If we can deploy floating offshore wind farms, typically that's not going to be conducive to trawling, for example. And those areas can really, I suppose, help to achieve then some biodiversity enhancements and become de facto marine protected areas. So it's this whole full cycle. And I just, yeah, so for me, floating offshore wind and what we can do here, it just hits all the boxes.
Yeah, no, it is fascinating. And I think, you know, I've been out at offshore wind farms, and I think for a lot of people, people don't get a sense of the scale of this. You know, people still think wind energy is kind of a small game. You know, some of the scale of what's happening around Europe and so on is just phenomenal. And these individual turbines are just, you know, in and of themselves, power stations, each one of them. And it really is an enormous opportunity and kind of underpins, or it's foundational to decarbonizing our economy, you know. So We've jumped on a lot of things there, Val, on your career and so on. And for anybody who's listening, I think it should be patently obvious, you know, why SEI nominated you and why the chair selected you this year for outstanding contribution to sustainable energy at our awards. So that was back in October. We've missed each other a few times for this podcast. Indeed. Since then. Finally got together on Christmas week. But I'm just wondering, you know, when you look back on your career, which you've very eloquently kind of taken me through there, what did that mean to you to get the award? And I suppose, how's it going to help you in your work to have a personal accolade like that?
Well, look, it was absolutely wonderful to be acknowledged in that way. It was a surprise, and it was just a really wonderful day out. But it wasn't just a day, you know. It's sitting on top of the piano at home, and it's just to look at that and to sort of note that there was that recognition for what's been achieved thus far, not just by me on my own, because nobody can ever do anything on their own. It's together with the team and all the wonderful people that you have a chance to work with. But you know, having that recognition, it keeps you going. It's wonderful to know that there's, you know, amongst your peers, that there are people that are aligned with the mission and the vision. And I do believe that wholeheartedly. I think that as much as anything else, the award recognised a point in time whereby, you know, everything that we've been talking about now, marine resources, marine resource management, you know, the climate targets, that all of that is absolutely prescient. So it's, you know, it's often said, it sounds trite, it's humbling. It is, but it's just fantastic to receive it for the way that it recognises marine energy and all the people that are over the years, including SEAI, so instrumental in getting this sector going and supporting it through R&D and different programmes over the years.
Yeah, and I was sat beside Peter Coyle actually at the awards, and you were talking about all of the people who've come before, and he's obviously a stalwart in the sector. And to see his pride in you standing up there was very heartening as well. And so we've touched on kind of Ireland's response to climate action, but I do want to kind of get your thoughts on that. You know, we both know, and I presume 99% of our listeners to this podcast are going to have an understanding of what a crisis we're in as a species, and what a challenge we have ahead as a country and a society and a global society. Give me your thoughts on sort of where we are, you know, because this is obviously a pretty big moment in your career to be recognised from this point of view. But, you know, it's certainly by no means the end of your career. You know, what's your kind of stock take at the moment? Where is Ireland in terms of climate action? And what do we need to do over the next number of years? What are the urgent actions that you see facing us as a society?
Ireland has been described as a climate laggard. And I think we have huge challenges in relation to dealing with our need to meet climate targets going forward. That said, you know, what I've experienced over the last couple of years has been unprecedented in relation to really a transformational agenda that goes to the heart of government. So first and foremost, we didn't have a fit for purpose marine planning framework. We do now. Actually, that was the gift last Christmas.
Yeah.
So the government legislated for the new Maritime Area Plan Act. And really important to have those foundational aspects of a regulatory environment in place so that we can surge forward. The challenge for us is that we came to that very late. And so we've had to accelerate. And there's just a lot of work to be done to get the regulatory house in order. I have no doubt of the motivation of government departments and agencies with regards to this. But of course, there's always frustration that it's not going fast enough. And from the outside looking in, you know, there's always consideration of how things might be done just a little bit more efficiently and effectively. I'll give one example of, you know, why it can be so frustrating and you know, why we're not in crisis mode. And so, for example, to deploy, you know, offshore wind turbines, you need to study the environment. We've been talking about that. In order to study the environment, you need a foreshore license. In order to get a foreshore license, you apply to the Department of Housing, which we did, for example, for the Emerald project off Cork 2.5 years ago. And we're still waiting for a license to survey inside 12 nautical miles. In other countries in the UK and elsewhere, those licences are issued within a matter of weeks or months. In some cases, licences aren't necessary if you're a fit and proper person that can demonstrate that there's not going to be any intrusion in terms of physical environment. So if you're, for example, collecting certain types of data, these things should be fast-tracked. And instead, we see that there is just a huge backlog of applicants and a system that is just absolutely dysfunctional, and we're all waiting anxiously for the new Maritime Area Regulatory Agency to open its doors in 2023. So we're turning the corner into the new year. We fully anticipate that, but I sometimes my confidence is shook when I think of the task ahead to try and turn around a process like that. It should be so simple, but we seem to make it extraordinarily complex. I think if we were actually in real crisis mode, we'd be picking off problems like that and just sorting them out. So I'm definitely a glass half full person, yeah. 100%. But I do think, I've just taken the platform here to flag that it's a, you know, there's great work been done by wonderful officials, but we're still missing a trick in terms of crisis mode and acceleration. And we have to be hopeful. We have to be hopeful that in this country, we're going to be able to do our bit. We have to be hopeful that there will be a regulatory system that will allow industry to move forward. We have to be hopeful that there will be a body in civil society that will understand the need for this. I mean, as you said yourself, Fergus, it's huge infrastructure. You know, it's not for the faint-hearted. Yeah. These are huge, massive offshore engineering projects. And a concern that I would have is that we get so bogged down in process that we miss the opportunity to achieve any progress.
And on that, like, you know, so when we come back, circle right round to your sort of roots and origins in the marine environment, and this is one of the key challenges we face, which is the solutions to climate action or to the climate crisis. A lot of them require mega projects of the type we're talking about. But yet we need to do that in a way that is sensitive to the people who may not want them, the people who are going to be impacted from them. So, you know, I'd be interested in your thoughts of how do we sort of marry up that need for speed with need for doing it in the right way?
I think it's all about information. It's all about honesty, transparency and you know, communication of what's at stake here. So one of the books I read during the year was Michael Mann's The New Climate Wars. And Michael Mann is an amazing climate scientist and communicator. He was responsible for the hockey stick curve. And, you know, it really struck a chord with me when I read what he had to say, which is that the only way we're going to deal with these treacherous levels of carbon in the atmosphere is to tax the hell out of fossil fuels. Number two, go after big ticket renewable infrastructure as a huge priority. And number three, help society to pave the way for that to happen. And I think, you know, what we are talking about is big ticket renewable infrastructure. Ireland has a unique opportunity to play its part, not just in terms of achieving our own energy targets or climate targets, but helping with regards to energy security in Europe, which of course is such a critical issue now. We see the devastating consequences of the war in Ukraine in that regard. But it's listening to what people like Michael Mann have to say, and then really helping to, I suppose, interpret that in terms of the Irish context, which is, you know, it's all about trade-offs at the end of the year. There's no such thing as utopia. There's no such thing as the perfect decision. You know, I think that what we need to understand is that what's at stake by not doing this fundamentally is an acidified ocean. So if we don't deploy renewable energy, if we don't arrest climate change, if we don't stop carbon being taken up by the oceans, we won't have a fishing industry to fight about. We won't have benthic systems to talk about. We won't have those precious, charismatic marine species, whales, dolphins, basking sharks, etc., to take photographs and to talk about. So fundamentally, it's about communicating at every opportunity to understand what's at stake here and to help people understand that there are trade-offs. And it's almost a case of go big or go home at this stage.
Yeah. Okay, so the Christmas wish list is a need for speed, a need for the state, and all actors to act like we're in a crisis. Is that fair?
Perfectly said.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fine. I strongly agree with that. I think it's absolutely, there has been a scale up in action, but we're a ways off where we need to get to. And I think everybody who's close to the sector understands that. So we've identified you, I suppose, with this award as a leader in the sector. You're up there now with Mary Donnelly, Duncan Stewart and Seamus Hoyne being our three previous winners of this award. And I'm interested, you know, what does climate leadership look like to you? So who's your inspirational climate leader?
I would have to say Professor Robert Devoy, who was my PhD supervisor in UCC. Robert is a coastal geomorphologist, and he was one of the first Irish scientists to contribute to an intergovernmental panel for climate change working group probably about 15 years ago. And Robert, I think, certainly through his work, was one of the first people to create a really good understanding as to what climate change would mean for the marine environment in the Irish context, and certainly what it would mean in terms of the response of the coastal ecosystem. I had the pleasure of working with Robert through my PhD, but most recently we co-produced the Coastal Atlas of Ireland together, which was published by Cork
Christmas.
University Press. Yeah, it was a great Christmas present.
It was. And I got it from my dad as well. We
fantastic.
Two of them in the family.
Great taste. But look, Robert was the founding editor of that, and he's just been an amazing inspiration, mentor, friend, just an incredible scientist, a great communicator, deeply authentic about all of these issues. And when I hear people like Robert begin to talk about runaway climate change and, you know, tipping points being exceeded, it's extremely concerning and alarming. And, you know, there are certain voices that one listens to amongst a lot of noise. And I would commend Robert for the work that he's done in terms of climate science in this country. And just as an example of somebody who's just working away, he's Professor Emeritus now, and obviously very impactful in terms of the work that he did in relation to the climate and science chapters in the Coastal Atlas of Ireland also.
Okay, thanks. And then on a similar theme, you're obviously now a very, you know, inspirational and female role model in the energy sector, which is a pretty male-dominated sector. You spoke, actually, I was talking to somebody this morning about you speaking at the awards, and you spoke really beautifully about mentorship and the mentors that you had in your life and so on. But I suppose in a sector that's quite male-dominated, I'm really interested in your views in terms of what can the kind of female leaders and the male leaders in the sector do to support women in bridging the gaps that exist in the sector?
Yeah, I think I had a lovely opportunity through the award ceremony to acknowledge those mentors who've been so personally significant to me. So Peter Coyle, who you mentioned earlier on, and Mark Mellett also. So I've had the benefit of seeing how good mentorship works. And fundamentally for me, it's about passing that on. But passing that on in a way that we can maybe focus a little bit more on the diversity issue. In relation to, you know, me coming into Simply Blue, one of the initial initiatives that got involved in was working right across the team to identify what our company values were, and those values being really important as the sort of the glue that holds everyone together. And it was interesting, at the time we had a bit of a debate because I wanted to make sure that diversity was in there. And it was a really robust and very honest debate because, you know, what was said to me is that we don't look very diverse. We're kind of all, we all look the same here. And, you know, my point was, look, if we don't put it down, then we won't be reminded of just this obligation to constantly seek opportunities to promote diversity and inclusion. And that's about gender, but it's also about much, much more than that. Even in our approach to civil society engagement, it's about always being able to put yourself in somebody else's shoes and try and see the world from their point of view and their worldview. So look, we have amazing emerging leaders and incredible leaders within Simply Blue Group, people like Patricia Comiskey, who's ex-SEAI, people like Marie Gleeson, who's ex-Irish Naval Service. I mean, they have, in their own stories, they blow me away. They're absolutely inspiring. But I think shared across the board is just this need, but also this willingness to look out for each other. And actually, the last meeting that I have tomorrow evening before I wrap up for Christmas is the working group on inclusion and diversity. And so we, you know, we get together as a team and have, you know, scheduled time to say, well, what are we doing about this? How are we addressing it in soft ways, but also in more sort of target orientated fashions also? And I think that's becoming more of a norm within business, within industry. During the course of this year, I did a diploma. I still have to take my exams, mind you, I haven't passed it yet, but a diploma in corporate governance through the Corporate Governance Institute. And the whole theme of equity, diversity and inclusion was very much to the fore in relation to corporate governance. It's no longer just about the balance sheets and how to read a P&L statement. It's very much about those responsibilities and those duties of a board to be mindful of this. So I think it's becoming part of the common parlance, but for a second, it's not something we should take for granted. It's something that we need to work on every single day. And fundamentally, it's about giving it back and just looking out for those around you.
Yeah. Okay, really well said. So Dr. Val Cummins, who is a 2022 Outstanding Contribution to Sustainable Energy as part of the SEAI Energy Awards, thank you very much for your time. Congratulations on the award. And I hope your Christmas wishes come true. And we'll talk to you in 2023.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. If you've enjoyed it, then please like, share and subscribe to our podcast. You'll find previous episodes on our website, seai.ie/podcast, along with information about our grants and supports. Until next time.